Looks as if everyone is now present. Good morning. I'm calling to order the calendar today of the Minnesota Court of Appeals, July 8th, 2020. We have WebEx hearings that are being conducted today. The panel composition is that of myself, Renee Werke presiding, Judge Francis Connolly, and Judge Tracy Smith. The first matter to be heard is file number A19-1814 in re the Trust of Lawrence B. Schwager. I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly. Attorneys, I want you to remember to mute your microphone if you're not speaking so that we don't have background noise. Please introduce yourself and name which party you're speaking on behalf of for our record purposes. And appellant counsel, when you're ready to proceed, go ahead. We can see you.
Okay, thank you and good morning. May it please the court, my name is Joseph Ganji. I represent the appellants in this matter. The briefs here are really just plump full of content. There's lots of issues raised. There's many statutes cited, many cases. From the appellant's perspective, it really boils down to two main issues, and those are the first two presented in the opening brief. The first being who owns the assets, and that involves an issue of interpreting and applying the trust language. The second issue being whether Phyllis Schwager could or did waive her right to any of those assets. And that issue involves both legal and factual components to it. The appellants would ask that the court reverse the district court's order in this matter because the district court did misapply the trust language and did misapply the law of waiver in this context.
This is an extremely large file and the briefs were, as you indicated, full of content as well as case law. As I understand it in your briefing, you're acknowledging that if we agree with your initial position as far as interpretation of the trust, that the other issues need not be addressed, that the first issue is dispositive?
To a point that if Phyllis owned the assets, and that kind of goes to the farmland and application of the farm real estate. There's also other issues of other assets, including the residence, and there's some tangible property such as the CDs and some other things that the district court that were not disposed of from the option to purchase piece, but rather passed to Phyllis through Article 3. But then the district court determined that there was a waiver of those assets. So that would be the second issue presented, which I think the court would need to also address. So when we talk about the first issue about whose assets are these, it's all about interpreting the plain language of the trust. And that is what we're talking about is in Article 3.3.3 of the trust. And I think it's important to maybe just go there quickly. This is on page 7 of my brief. This piece has two components to it. The first gives to Phyllis all interests in property used for residential purposes. And then once you figure out what that is, the second piece of that article also gives to Phyllis all real estate contiguous to or used in connection with that property, or such property being the residential type property. So the question is, is the farm real estate included in that second portion of Article 3.3.3? And I think the answer is absolutely. Under the plain language, we first look at the first part, residential purposes. What is that? There's a farm site, there's a home, there's a yard. Those properties are used for residential purposes. Then you get to the next part, all real estate contiguous to that property, which is the home or the farm site. The farm real estate here is absolutely contiguous to that. It's used in connection with that. It's all one big family farm. It's all used in connection with each other. That's the way they've always run it. So if you just apply that plain language, article here does pass by a specific request under Article 3.
Relative to that, then what? Two questions, I guess. What would that leave? That's a special distribution. What would Article 4, what would the remaining trust assets be if, I assume the farm is the largest asset here. Would there be other assets left in Article 4 if your reading is correct? And then secondly, my second question is, if this were ambiguous and one considered the other, the prior provision, would your position change on the meaning of 3.3?
So with the first question, would there be any other assets in the trust? I don't believe so. And that's because of the application of the other pieces of Article 3. There's, for example, I'll just pull that up here. Article 3.3.1 gives all the tangible personal property to Phyllis. And Article 3.3.3 gives all of the real estate to Phyllis. And that's pretty much what I believe to be all of the trust assets.
So isn't it a little odd that special distributions would distribute everything and there'd be nothing left in Article 4 for the remaining trust assets? I mean, what does that leave us for Article 4's meaning then?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I think it just depends on what the assets are. Sometimes it's just applying the plain language of the trust and determining what are the assets and what gets distributed where. And there may be assets that don't get conveyed pursuant to Article 3. For example, if there was other real estate that was maybe a cabin somewhere, that would go to Article 4. If there was other types of property that did not fit this definition, then Article 4 would kick in. So we have to look at this in connection with what the state actually had and then distribute it according to how Article 3 is set up.
Okay, and in my earlier question, I'm sorry to have you jump around, but would you agree that it would have to mean this language, which I think remained stable between the original and then the amendment, would it have to mean something different if the original trust were effective?
I don't believe so. I don't believe those, the option to purchase is what you're referring to, I believe, Your Honor, which was revoked. The language in there does refer to farm real estate, and that originally had an option to purchase, and then if nobody purchased it, it would end up being sold and going to the residue. I do not believe that changes the language or application of Article 3.3.3 at all. It's not inconsistent with it, for one. Even though we're talking about farm real estate in one and all real estate contiguous to the residence in Article 3, it's going back to that idea that you're still applying the language to the assets that are there. So if the option to purchase is still in effect, then you would go through that and say, okay, well, the farmland has to be distributed this way. And then at the end of that option to purchase, it actually states, at the end of that, it says, following that, then I direct that upon my death, and then it goes on to list what happens to whatever else is remaining in the trust. And
obviously, so in that case, you're arguing that all real estate contiguous to or used in connection with such property might have been diminished had the option to purchase been purchased under the first one. So it's not in conflict, you're saying that, yeah, Jerome could have purchased it all under the original one with an option to purchase, leaving the special distribution to Phyllis much smaller under 3.3.3.
That's correct. Yes, absolutely. Yep. And it's all about applying what's there. So without the option to purchase, the farm real estate didn't go anywhere. And so when we get to Article 3, that's part of the estate that then gets distributed to Phyllis.
Can you explain to me, I don't follow the court, how this led up with the judge initially saying it was unambiguous, and then in post-trial motions determining it was ambiguous, was there some documents that were called to her attention or his attention?
No, Your Honor. So originally this was unambiguous, and then on post-trial motions, there was an argument made by the appellants that it was error to look at the option to purchase because that is extrinsic evidence. And if Article 3 is ambiguous, you cannot look at extrinsic evidence to interpret or create ambiguity within the trust language. And at that point, the district court I guess, changed its mind and said, well, okay, then it is ambiguous. And therefore, I'm going to, I can go and look at the option to purchase. That's my understanding. There was no other.
Your position then, as far as appellant, that it doesn't matter, same result is achieved?
Correct. And I don't even think this really is an issue of ambiguity to begin with. Because ambiguity requires two reasonable interpretations of the language. And here, the interpretation just is not reasonable.
Counselor, does your argument depend on your reading of 3.3.3? In other words, what if the conclusion were it was ambiguous and in fact there was a marital trust that was created with the assets in the marital trust and the trustee, Phyllis, decided later to sell them at less than market value to her son? Do you still lose, or is what, or do you have, well, do you still lose? Does your argument rise or fall on the interpretation of 3.3.3?
I don't believe so, because if I'm incorrect on the interpretation of Article 3.3.3, then we go to Article 4, which it's appellant's position that the trust then went, or the assets then go into the marital share of the trust, and so that they still belong to Phyllis.
And they still belong to her in that. Can you tease that out a little bit? They still belong to her when they're in the marital trust.
Right. There's not necessarily a marital trust, so to speak. It's a marital share of the trust that the assets would fall to. So you would take the assets into Article 4, and then those get divided between the marital share and the family share. And it's appellant's position that under the estate as it is, all of the assets went into a marital share, or if they did pass into Article 4, they would have gone into a marital share. And from there, those were distributable to Phyllis. And so at that point, whenever she decided to distribute them to herself, those were her assets. They didn't go into the irrevocable family trust portion of the residue.
Mr. Ganji, your time is running down. You indicated that the other primary important issue for you is waiver. Can you address that?
Yes, thank you.
It appears it's in Article 4, waiver provisions.
No, the waiver argument is actually an Article 3 issue. So the district court concluded that Phyllis got the residence under Article 3, but that she waived her right to the residence. And so it passed down to Article 4 because she waived her right. And to me, that's the wrong legal principle. What we should be talking about is disclaimer, which creates kind of a legal fiction, so to speak. It pretends that the person has passed away, and then the property then skips over them, and you get a legal benefit from having disclaimed property. But to take advantage of that legal fiction and get that legal benefit of having the property skip over you, you have to follow the disclaimer statute. Those formalities must be followed. And here we don't have any disclaimer by Phyllis at all. And it's significant, because if you don't follow the disclaimer statute, the law will treat the property as if you still own it. And that's what really is going on here, is we don't have a disclaimer. The law, therefore, is going to treat the property as if Phyllis still owns it. And I think also significantly what we have is the district court finding a waiver based on tax benefits. And That reasoning really doesn't hold a lot of weight, because you don't get the tax benefit unless you have that valid disclaimer. You've got to have it. So if the intent was actually to put these assets into the family trust, then there would have been the disclaimers executed initially to get those assets in there, because otherwise the assets don't go into that family trust.
Mr. Ganji, I did have just one question. So in your mind, what was, when this was set up, the purpose? Was it solely sort of to reduce taxes? I mean, if he wanted his wife to have all the property, He could have just given her all the property. Or if he wanted the son to just get the farm, he could have given the son the farm, and you know, she would have had a life estate in it until, you know, she died. So what was the purpose of this trust, do you believe?
I think the purpose of the trust was to ensure that whatever surviving parent maintained control of the assets while they were still alive, and set it up so that they could decide what happens when moving forward, which is basically what happened here with Phyllis, as she controlled the assets and decided, okay, I'm going to keep the family farm intact. That was a big key to this. We need to keep the family farm intact. And that's how Phyllis did that with Jerome. And I think that's maybe kind of the bigger picture here, is the intent here was not to equalize things, that the intent here was to make sure that the family farm was intact. The district court's order is contrary to that, contrary to the trust and the law and that overall intent. And so we'd ask the court to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Scangie. You'll have your rebuttal time. We'll turn to respondent counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Joe Cassiope from Frederickson and Byron. We represent Barbara Higginbotham, who was the petitioner in the trial court and respondent on appeal. Two preliminary things. First, I'm in Minneapolis. The lightning is just coming through now. So if at any point you can't hear me, please just raise a hand and I'll speak louder or try to fix it. The other piece is, Your Honor asked about what how to interpret the name. It's Schwagel. It took me about 3 years to get there, but I've got it eventually. The district court in this case was presented with serious misconduct and blatant breaches of fiduciary duty by the trustees of the Lawrence Schwagel Family Trust. The trustees sold the trust's most valuable asset, his real estate holdings, to a company owned by one of the trustees for only approximately one-fifth of its value. The trustees then refused to provide any information about the trust to its beneficiaries. They wouldn't even give a copy of the trust agreement to the beneficiaries. And then, most egregiously, while this case was pending, after the district court denied their motion to dismiss, the trustees surreptitiously raided the trust, took all of the trust assets, and transferred them to a different trust without informing the beneficiaries and without informing the court. Based on the evidence deduced at trial, the district court properly removed Diana Miller as trustee and appointed a neutral trustee to recover the assets that had been raided from the trust. Appellants cannot establish that the district court, any of its findings were clearly erroneous, or that it abused its discretion.
Mr. Cassiope, did I pronounce your name correctly?
You did. You did, Your Honor.
You know, the thing I have was, and you know, you can always change your mind, but you know, to go from unambiguous to ambiguous, based solely on sort of the post judgment motions, which suggested that the judge, you know, got it wrong, was a problem in the analysis as to the way he wanted to get out. You know, it does smack to me a little bit of results oriented. I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hope I can change your mind on this, because there was a very good reason why the district court Judge Dahl did what she did on this. At trial, with trial counsel, and this is really important because it goes to why have we, on four or five different occasions, based on the arguments raised by appellants and appeals, said that they waived them or didn't preserve them. Well, the reason is they went through five different law firms in the district court, appellants did, and including three since trial. And so trial counsel made specific strategic decisions at trial that counsel, when they filed their motion for a new trial, disagreed with. And the key one, and the one that answers your question here, is both appellants and my client at trial specifically asked the court to analyze and include the original Article 3 in her analysis of the trust, right? And so the court, Judge Dahl, looking at the original trust and the First Amendment, said, reading these together, there is no ambiguity. And so therefore, I find that that the farmland was not intended to go in the specific distribution. Then appellants obtained new counsel and they argued for the first time in a post-trial motion that the court wasn't allowed to consider the original trust agreement, at which point Judge Dahl, in her order denying that motion, said, well, I don't know if it's really extrinsic evidence, but if you're saying that I need to read Section 3.3.3 alone, then it is ambiguous without reference to the other portion of the trust. So there was never a change in her mind. What the judge explained was is that if you don't read those two provisions together, Section 3.3.3 is ambiguous. But if you do read them together, there is no ambiguity. So nothing inconsistent there whatsoever.
What two provisions are we supposed to be reading now?
The original Article 3 that had the specific distribution to or the specific purchase option for the real estate. And then it's also the original 3.3.3, which never changed. So there was a First Amendment which got rid of, that was signed the very same day, that got rid of that purchase option. And so at trial, everyone agreed you can look at those two together. For the first time post-trial, which of course you can't do, and the district court does not abuse its discretion by denying an argument raised for the first time in a motion for a new fine for amended findings. And we cited the Clark case and others for that. For the first time, new counsel motion for new amended findings said, Judge, you weren't even supposed to look at that. Forget what my previous counsel for my client said. You weren't even supposed to look at that. At which point the judge said, well, ambiguous if you don't look at it.
I'm going to ask you Judge Connolly's question because I thought it was excellent. What's the purpose of the trust under your client's analysis, her opinion? I mean, what was the whole point of having the trust?
The purpose of, and I would refer the court specifically to the testimony of Thomas Wilson, who testified at length. I believe it's at pages 52.
But didn't Thomas Wilson acknowledge that he didn't really have much to do with talking to Jerome or anyone else in making his analysis?
He spoke with counsel for Jerome. He spoke with counsel for Diana, and he reviewed over 1,600 pages, including the contemporaneous notes of Phyllis, her accountant, and her attorney back in 2000.
But and I interrupted your answer. And what was the basis or the logic then of the trust?
This is a very standard form marital trust, family trust. And purpose of it, as explained, you want to fund a family trust to the highest amount allowed under current law. So at that time, it was $650,000. So you want to put at least $650,000 into a family trust. And the spouse can live off of that, the income from that, during her lifetime. But then it allows it to pass tax-free to the descendants and it doesn't become a part of the spouse's estate. And again, I refer the court to Mr. Wilson's testimony. So it's put as much as possible into the family trust so that doesn't get taxed at the time that Phyllis passes away. And in 1999 and 2000, that amount was $650,000. I want to.
Can I ask a question about that? Oh, I'm sorry, Judge Connolly.
No, I mean, I think Judge Smith and I may be on the same path. So if she's going to do that, doesn't she have to disclaim?
She does not. So two reasons for that, Your Honor. The way that the trust agreement works is, and this is 4.1.1. It's a three-part analysis. The first is, it says fund a marital share up to the marital exemption. And at that point it was unlimited. So you would put everything into the marital share. The second step says, but put as much into the family share as you can to make my estate go right up to the limit of the unified credit. So that's basically shift $650,000 over into the family share. And then the third part under 4.1.1, it says you need to then equalize those two provisions. So in this case, because we had approximately $1 million estate, you would have ended up with $500,000 in the family share and about $500,000 in the marital share. And only the family share then is held in trust going forward. I really want, and this is really important. I want to go ahead. Your Honor, I can't hear you.
Judge Connolly.
I mean, that does depend. I mean, that's all fine, provided, you know, you're above the $1.2 million. And I mean, I thought the evidence would suggest that never happened. Now, I mean, I know you can argue that, well, it didn't happen because, you know, he sold it at a she sold it. It's, you know.
No, Your Honor.
Is that right?
And again, I would direct the court to pages 52 through 55 of the transcript where Mr. Wilson walks through how these provisions work. If there's $500,000 in trust, it would get split 250-250. If there's $1.5 million in trust, only $650,000 would go into the family trust and everything else would go into the marital trust. And you need to walk through all three of those clauses in 4.1.1 to get there. So from the marital trust.
But that does, let me try this. That does depend on whether we believe it was the intention when the trust was set up that everyone is going to get equally, as opposed to, you know, mom gets it all and then the son gets it because, you know, with the farm intact, because he's the one who took care of him all these years, right?
Yeah. The option to the son disappeared in the First Amendment. So that was gotten rid of. And Your Honor, I want to reorient the court to what I think really matters here and what is dispositive and is the only issue that the court needs to decide. And that is, regardless of what the language of the trust technically would have done, and I'd refer the court to Mr. Wilson's report on this because I think he really did a nice job of it. He said that the funding of this trust didn't take place technically according to the terms of the trust because you would have had basically an equal split. Phyllis and her advisors and attorneys at the time in 2000 made the intentional decision, and the district court made specific findings about this on pages 27 and 28 of appellant's addendum, that Phyllis intentionally funded the family trust to almost the limit, about $640,000, try to shelter as many assets as possible for taxes. She even said to her accountant, "I wish there was more money that we could put into the family trust." That position was undisputed.
But that's all confusing to me. I understand the goal of this trust is less about funding that to the 650, and it's more about, upon Phyllis's death, trying to diminish her estate, right? So it's not taxed, right? And so you have the family trust to move some assets over there. And now you're talking about Phyllis wanted to move even more assets over there. But the fact that she even had the authority to move more assets, what does that mean but that they're her assets to choose where to put them?
At the point of the funding of the trust, so you had the Lawrence Schwegel Trust, and it had a marital share and a family share. At the point of the funding, Phyllis made the intentional decision, yes, I would have the right to take half and put it into the marital share. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to fund the family share to the maximum amount possible. And at that point, it became the family trust. And at that point, she was trustee of the family trust. And as trustee, she had a fiduciary duty to the beneficiaries where she couldn't change her mind 15 years later and say, yeah, I'm going to pull everything back out of trust. Those were the findings of the court. And that goes to the waiver argument. She made the intentional decision to fund that trust to the highest extent possible under the law. And having done that and having acted accordingly to that for 15 years, she was not then permitted, in violation of her fiduciary duty, her highest duty of care and loyalty to her beneficiaries, to say, I'm mad because some of my daughters have brought this case. I'm going to take everything out of a trust that has been consistently administered for 15 years and put it somewhere else to punish three of my daughters.
Why do the 15 years matter? When does this alleged waiver take place? At the start of, on year one, that moment, or 15 years later?
As soon as she funded the trust and became a trustee with fiduciary duties to her beneficiaries, that's the waiver.
So the 15 years is irrelevant.
Well, the 15 years is relevant in that it shows there's an argument being no family trust ever set up. In the manner set forth in Article 6. So it goes to that point. But yes, as soon as she funded the trust and became a trustee with fiduciary duties to the beneficiaries, she could not do anything that was contrary to the interests of those beneficiaries under fundamental principles of trust law in Minnesota.
I don't know that it was in the briefs, but in the trust under 8.2, I believe it permits a trustee, say it's Phyllis, let's forget about Jerome for a moment, to sell, exchange, et cetera, property on any terms and conditions to any individual and so on. What would stop Phyllis from choosing to sell at below market value? And I guess given that provision, and also, go ahead and answer that question.
As a fundamental principle of a trust law, when a trustee is provided discretionary powers under Minnesota law, and this issue didn't come up until now, so I don't have a citation for you, but if a trustee is provided discretionary powers, they have to exercise good faith in exercising those. And so Phyllis could not sell assets for less than fair market value unless it was the best in the best interests of all our beneficiaries. And under no circumstances could you establish that here.
And so just so I understand, I want to make sure on the simplest level I understand the dispute. The dispute is between there being zero in the family trust for the beneficiaries and it's all, zero there. There being 500,000 or whatever it was, the half market value, or there being undoing it all and getting the whole shebang back, right, in the family trust.
Those are the issues the courts presented. Frankly, based on what actually happened historically, as found by the district court, there is no dispute. This family trust was funded with $640,000 worth of assets and maintained that way up until. I would like to, if I could just have 30 seconds.
You can go ahead and sum up, please.
Yeah. For the reasons set forth in our brief, we ask that this court affirm everything. And just very 10 seconds on the disclaimer piece. The issue that a statutory disclaimer was needed for Phyllis to waive her rights was not raised, period. Was not raised at all until appellants brought new counsel and filed a motion for a new trial. So it was waived under well-established Minnesota law.
Thank you. We'll go back to appellant counsel. You have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. A few comments. First, about past counsel agreeing that article, that the option to purchase was part of this. I don't have the same reading of what the arguments were at the trial and with the prior counsel. It seems to me that the Article 3 was simply a fact. We have an option to purchase, there it is. But the arguments have consistently been that Article 3 allocates all of those assets to Phyllis.
Counsel, is it not the case, or explain if it is or isn't, that the argument that you're making now is inconsistent with the history, with the documentation, even with tax returns? Can you speak to that? I mean, did the tax returns not suggest that there was, in fact, a family trust funded with assets by Phyllis?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor. The way I read the tax return is that it set forth all of the assets that are in the Lawrence Schwagerl Trust. And when you have those assets in the trust, now you have to go through the trust language and distribute them accordingly to what the trust says. Now that
the Lawrence trust that was attacked.
The argument that it wasn't identified as far as what the purpose of the trust was, counsel had argued that there's three sections to Article 3. All of that assumes that Article 4, there's three parts to Article 4, and so counsel went through how those get allocated. That assumes that Article 3 does not exist, but Article 3 does exist. You have to go through Article 3 first, and then and only then do you get down to Article 4 to distribute amongst a marital share or a family share. So,
but why weren't there assets besides the real property and the personal property? Like, weren't there cash assets? I mean, how did those figure in under Article 3?
I believe there were some CDs and maybe some farm equipment. I'm not exactly sure the entire contents of the.
Right. I mean, when you look at that tax return, it lists a whole bunch of assets, which include. Included grain, maybe I forget what else, but are you, I think you're suggesting that there's nothing left for Article 4 because it's all taken care of in the special distributions in Article 3, but what about those assets?
I believe so. I mean, again, it would just be a matter of applying what is in Article 3 and what isn't. So
that's what I'm
if
asking.
We look at Article 3,
what happens to
right,
cash?
The tangible, the CDs, if they don't get distributed under Article 3, then they would get distributed under Article 4 and then divide.
Okay, are they distributed under, were they distributed under Article 3? Were they covered by Article 3? Was every asset covered by Article 3?
I don't know for sure, Your Honor. I think there was testimony by Attorney Selnow that there were some assets that did go into Article 4 and then got dispersed. And those might have been some cash assets.
But okay, so then where is the family trust then? Shouldn't there have been a family trust under, or what happens under Article 4 to non-Article 3 assets is my question.
Right, so as I've mentioned, then all of those assets go into the marital share of that because the amount of the estate. So as you're looking at Article 4 and how that's distributed, at the end of Article 4, it actually states that that gets funded, the marital share gets funded at least equal to the amount of my federal taxable estate. So there, 650 all the way up until that marital deduction goes into the
okay,
marital
so
share.
There wasn't
that's how this particular
enough to do both. All right.
There wasn't enough to do both. So I think, you know, as far as what really matters here, I think we go straight to Phyllis's second affidavit, which was admitted for purposes of intent. Paragraph 18 of her affidavit, my husband and I built our farm and we scrimped, saved, did without, and raised 8 children. We have our own vision and legacy that is important to us. In paragraph 3, I don't have an interest in providing a lump sum inheritance by selling the farm outside of the family. I don't want to chop up the farm and split it amongst 8 or more people. My husband and I wanted the farm intact to retain the Schwagerl family name. And reversing the district court will ensure that that happens. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. The matters were well briefed and well argued today. A decision will be issued in the statutory timeframe. This court will recess and be in the lobby pending our next hearing. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.